what is still relevant for me among the beliefs and assumptions that were so much a part of my Mormon upbringing. In other words, it's time to ascertain how much remains of what I once considered to be a solid testimony. Over the years, my Mormon ties have been a source both of great exhilaration and profound disillusionment. And today, I propose to determine how the two sides of the ledger balance out. A major consideration in my desire to reassess my Mormon heritage is the fact that as I look back over the major turning points in my life, they generally tend to reflect my Mormon roots in remarkably positive and life-affirming ways. For example, my original intention to pursue a career in medicine was completely reoriented by my accepting a call to the French mission. And I need to say, in 1947, there was only one French mission. They'd been divided repeatedly since that time. It included all of France, all of French-speaking Switzerland, all of French-speaking Belgium. Within 6 months of my arrival in France, I became so enamored of French language and culture that I decided to abandon medicine in favor of an academic career in the humanities, a career which has led to my current position at the University of Utah as a professor of languages and literature and director of the honors program. By the way, I'll be alluding just in passing to the department. It originally was called the Department of Languages, and what, about 8 years ago, we added literature to it. We've always been teaching literature in the department, but it became official about 8 years ago when the name of the department was changed. So that's to clarify that. In the wake of the first major crisis of my life, the loss of my father when I was 12 years old, I adopted a number of very influential father figures, each with a strong Mormon identity, two of whom I'll have occasion to comment on in the remarks that follow. My remarks today focus on the issue of personal testimony for two major reasons. First, because I have always found the LDS notion of a testimony uniquely appealing as a mediating device between the individual member and the organizational church. Because I hold religion to be a highly personal experience, I am easily offended by anyone's claim to have a direct pipeline to God which has any bearing on me. If the Almighty has something to communicate to me, why can I not receive it directly? A personal testimony serves that distinct purpose. In other words, the church leadership claims to be the guardian and dispenser of certain divine truths, which I am not required to accept at face value, but rather am enjoined to accept on the basis of spiritual confirmation through personal channels available to me through prayer and study. And second, because I am in a sense picking up today where I left off nearly 9 years ago when I made a Pillars of My Faith presentation at the 1984 Sunstone Symposium, which appeared subsequently in Dialogue under the title of Out of the Crucible, The Testimony of a Liberal, and in which, half jokingly, I described myself as having a 15% testimony, I believe I was wrong in attempting to quantify my level of belief because I was playing into the church's numbers game, which I have always deplored. After all, everything from your tithing to your attendance to your standing in the hereafter has to be quantified. I'm now much more concerned with reassessing what has become of my faith in qualitative terms. What is the quality of the testimony? In order to facilitate a discussion of my own testimony, I would like to make a few observations concerning the evolution of the whole idea of a testimony from the founding of the church up to the present time. Joseph Smith set the stage, of course, with his account of the first vision, based as it was on taking the admonition of James at face value, that if any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God, and it shall be given him. Joseph Smith affirmed that with earnest study and prayer, anyone can arrive at an understanding of spiritual truth. His comments on the subject of testimony always stress a balance between spiritual enlightenment and rational knowledge, as this quotation from a letter he wrote in November 1833 bears out. And I quote, "You remember the testimony which I bore in the name of the Lord Jesus concerning the great work which he has brought forth in the last days. I pray that the Lord may enable you to treasure these things in your mind, for I know that his Spirit will bear testimony of all who seek diligently after knowledge from him." Close quote. He really stresses the importance of coming to a rational grasp of spiritual truth in these remarks. And again, I quote, "We deem it a just principle, and it is one the force of which we believe ought to be duly considered by every individual, that all men are created equal, and that all have the privilege of thinking for themselves upon all matters relative to conscience. Consequently, then, we are not disposed, had we the power, to deprive anyone of exercising that free independence of mind which heaven has so graciously bestowed upon the human family as one of its choicest gifts." Close quote. Brigham Young continued to emphasize the rational and even philosophical nature of a personal testimony in the following terms. Many men and women who have obeyed the gospel and have not received from the Lord these striking testimonies will say, "Well, I really do not know that I can tell whether the gospel is true or not." To all such I say, "Then you are no philosophers at all. For upon the rational principles of common philosophy, you can tell whether it is true or not." B.H. Roberts, in offering a purely theological account of the basis for belief, provides the most thoroughgoing intellectual account of all, one which bears quoting at some length because his impassioned plea for a critically thoughtful approach to the gospel is so at odds with the almost mindless rote approach advocated in official circles today. And so I quote, "I maintain that simple faith, which is so often ignorant and simpering acquiescence and not faith at all, but simple faith taken at its understanding of the thing believed, is not equal to intelligent faith, the faith that is the gift of God, supplemented by earnest endeavor to find through prayerful thought and research a rational ground for faith, for acceptance of truth, and hence the duty of striving for a rational faith in which the intellect, as well as the heart and feeling, has a place and a factor. The people of simple faith who never question are so much easier led and so much more pleasant in every way. They give their teachers so little trouble. People who question because they want to know and who ask adult questions that call for adult answers disturb the ease of the priests. The people who question are usually the people who think, and thinkers are troublesome, unless the instructors who lead them are thinkers also. And thought, eternal, restless thought, that keeps out upon the frontiers of discovery, is as much a weariness to the slothful as it is a joy to the alert and active and noble-minded. Therefore, one must not be surprised if now and again he finds those among religious teachers who give encouragement to mental laziness under the pretense of reverence, praise simple faith because they themselves, forsooth, would avoid the stress of thought and investigation that would be necessary in order to hold their place as leaders of a thinking people." Close quote. Those are the good old days. Since the passing of B.H. Roberts in 1933, the trend has been increasingly away from basing one's faith on serious theological inquiry and more in favor of unquestioning compliance. An acceptable testimony is more a formulaic demonstration of total obedience, an outspoken ritual demonstration that one is not given to murmuring, than a laboriously forged personal creed. John A. Widsoe, an academically oriented younger contemporary of Roberts, espoused a balanced view of testimony, which nevertheless stressed its individual nature and the importance of putting forth thoughtful personal effort in achieving it. And again, I quote, "The learned and the unlearned, the youth and the veteran, the high and the humble, may bear a testimony alike. Each one learns the truth through his own powers. A conviction of the truth of the gospel, a testimony, must be sought if it is to be found. It does not come as the dew from heaven. It is the result of man's eagerness to know truth. Often it requires battle with traditions, former opinions, and appetites, and a long testing of the gospel by every available fact and standard." Close quote. We're moving forward now, I guess. Bruce R. McConkie's 1958 compendium, Mormon Doctrine, presumed to codify major points of doctrine, including an unambiguous description both of the manner in which a testimony was to be obtained, as well as its three essential characteristics. And I quote again, "A testimony of the gospel is the sure knowledge received by revelation from the Holy Ghost of the divinity of the great latter-day work. Three great truths must be included in every valid testimony." And it's nice to know exactly what has to be there. It's being spelled out in very specific terms. One, that Jesus Christ is the Son of God and the Savior of the world. Two, that Joseph Smith is the prophet of God through whom the gospel was restored in this dispensation. And three, that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is the only true and living church upon the face of the whole earth. Close quote. Now, in the second edition of that same work, published 8 years later, Elder McConkie added the following statement, as though he hadn't said enough, to further emphasize his insistence that the unaided intellect was incapable of attaining a testimony. And he said this, "If the sole source of one's knowledge or assurance of the truth of the Lord's work comes from reason or logic or persuasive argument that cannot be controverted, it is not a testimony of the gospel. In its nature, a testimony consists of knowledge that comes by revelation. It comes when the whisperings of the still small voice are heard by the inner man. Receipt of a testimony is accompanied by a feeling of calm, unwavering certainty. No room for much of anything. All right, 4 years later, Elder McConkie's father-in-law, President Joseph Fielding Smith, emphasized that a testimony, and I quote, is a revelation to the individual who earnestly seeks one by prayer, study, and faith. We again have three characteristics, and is the impression of speaking of the Holy Ghost to the soul in a convincing positive manner. And he adds the caveat that, quote, the person seeking for this knowledge will not have the privilege of repeated manifestations, since the Lord will reveal the truth once, close quote. So there again, not much room for questioning or doubt. If you ever, for even a moment, waver, you don't have a real testimony. You've got real problems there. Okay, long before he became president, Harold B. Lee emphasized that obedience is the hallmark of a true testimony, stating in 1950 that it is not alone sufficient for us as Latter-day Saints to follow our leaders and to accept their counsel, but we have the greater obligation to gain for ourselves, and I quote, the unshakable testimony of the divine appointment of these men and the witness that they have told us, that what they have told us is the will of our Heavenly Father, close quote. In 1972, as president of the church, he further elaborated on the theme of testimony by total obedience to authority when he announced that, and again I quote, that person is not truly converted until he sees the power of God resting upon the leaders of this church and until it goes down into his heart like fire. Adding that until the members of this church have a conviction that these men of God are men who are inspired and have been properly appointed by the hand of God, they are not truly converted, close quote. A close ally of President Lee on the Council of the Twelve, Elder Boyd K. Packer, epitomized this newly minted guiding principle with the now familiar admonition, follow the brethren. That was the title of an address that he delivered back in 1966, and it still resonates. The most extreme formulation of the view that one's testimony must be based on strict obedience to contemporary church leadership was set forth by President Ezra Taft Benson in a 1980 address entitled 14 Fundamentals on Following the Prophet, in which he insisted that, and I quote, the prophet is the only man that speaks for the Lord in everything, since he is authorized to receive revelation on anything, whether temporal or spiritual, including civic matters. He went so far as to insist that, quote, the living prophet is more vital to us than the standard works, and that his word supersedes the pronouncements of all previous church leaders, including the prophet Joseph Smith, close quote. Given that Elder Benson made these remarks 6 years before he succeeded to the presidency of the church at an age which one commentator referred to as a relatively robust 82, it is ironic how incapacitating senility has reduced him to little more than a figurehead, leading his 13-year-old great-grandson to ask ingenuously, why do they call him prophet when he can't do anything? Surely if one's testimony is to be based on the infallibility or even the ongoing viability of the living prophet, not to mention the subordinate brethren who are to be followed at all cost, such a testimony is destined sooner or later to founder, as the present circumstances so vividly demonstrates, as the realities of age and the frailty of the human condition. Founder on the realities of age and the frailty of the human condition. All right, to summarize, the notion of a testimony originally placed major emphasis on achieving certainty of the saving mission of Jesus Christ and of Joseph Smith as his latter-day emissary based on a balance between inspired faith and rational understanding. Over time, it has come to be based much more on proclaiming the incontrovertible validity of a certain set of religious truths through the exercise of faith without recourse to rational inquiry, and with special emphasis on the unquestioning acceptance of and compliance with the directives and admonitions of living ecclesiastical leaders. What had begun as an individually tailored testimony of the gospel has become more and more a ready-made testimony of the church. And that brings me back to my original intention to retrace the evolution, or devolution, of my own testimony in the context of these historical developments. As a child, I remember being both naive and critical in my attitude toward church. I was naive in accepting quite literally whatever I was told in Sunday school or primary, as long as it was explained in an understandable manner. An example of my naivete was my response to an account of the early history of the church by a Sunday school teacher who told of Joseph Smith being shown not only the golden plates from which he translated the Book of Mormon, but also in a cave deep in the hill Cumorah, many other plates, which were sealed, but which must someday come to light, she strongly suggested that if some member of that class, and that was way back when I was, about 10 or 11 years old, proved to be sufficiently worthy, that person might well be chosen as the instrument of the Lord to bring forth the mysteries contained on the plates. I remember being excited by such a prospect, only to feel let down when I later learned that there is no basis in fact for the account of the cave full of plates. This incident demonstrates a pattern which made it difficult for me to maintain a balanced testimony, a pattern of being expected to accept literalistic and even simplistic pronouncements which had great potential for ending in disillusionment. Despite occasional problems with perceived inconsistencies in church teachings and practices, I remained active and fiercely loyal to the church until well into my teens. Indeed, my basic testimony was not really challenged until I was engaged in pre-med studies at the University of Utah. One of my professors, a brilliant zoologist named Stephen Durant, was in the habit of pounding on his lectern as though it was a pulpit and declaring with deep conviction that evolution is no longer a theory, it's a law. He would repeat that almost every time he lectured to the class. It was not until much later that I learned that Professor Durant had served in the French mission and had returned to major in biology, where his studies led him to the conclusion that Darwin was right and Mormonism was wrong, thus launching him on a career of preaching Darwinism in the classroom with the same ardor that he had preached Mormonism in France. That was quite a discovery when I went on a French mission and met people who had actually heard him preach to them and had been converted by Steve Durant, who just about destroyed my testimony. Okay. This thinly veiled attack on revealed religion produced in me a great deal of inner turmoil, and I hardly knew where to turn for counsel. Fortunately, one of my closest friends at that time was a grandson of Elder John A. Widso, giving me ready access to the Apostle Scientist. I will never forget Dr. Widso's disarming cordiality and openness when I met him, and when he assured me that I should feel free to discuss anything with him, any doubts, questions, misgivings whatsoever. My fears and apprehensions about raising a controversial issue with a general authority were immediately put to rest. In the discussion that ensued, he offered a very lucid explanation of the complementarity of the two views of creation, religious and scientific, using the metaphor of a gulf which science and religion are both seeking to bridge. Although the bridge had not yet been completed, the portions under construction on either side of the chasm would point toward each other and would eventually meet. He said a lot more, but that's the substance of the way he put it. The net effect of the interview was to reassure me that in espousing the discoveries of science, I did not have to jettison my Mormon beliefs. Even more importantly, I concluded that the gospel and the church were both broad and open enough to accommodate a whole range of truths, and that the leadership of the church was as enlightened as it was compassionate. In Elder Widso, I had found an important substitute father, and it was largely thanks to him and his availability for serious religious exchanges that I decided to go on a mission. The mission call itself had something miraculous about it, although at the time it seemed to me to be anything but a miracle. I had studied the German language and had expressed the desire to be sent to a German-speaking mission, or, if possible, to Norway, with my friend Elder Widso's grandson. When the names of my contingent of missionaries were brought before the Council of the Twelve, Elder Widso assured me that I was definitely down for the Norwegian mission. What, then, was my surprise and disappointment a short time later when I received a call, horror of horrors, to the French mission. Clearly something had happened when my name was presented to the First Presidency, and appalled as I was at the time, it was clear in retrospect that the change was an inspired one, and I will never know. It really was Norway at the level of the Council of the Twelve, and it turned out to be France. And I thought, why do they want to corrupt me this way, sending me to France, of all things? Okay. My mission president was Professor James L. Barker, former chair of the Department of Languages, to which I currently belong. He proved to be another important father figure who, thanks to his profound knowledge of primitive Christianity and its close ties to the restored church, contributed greatly to my understanding of the gospel, just as his skills as a linguist contributed immeasurably to my mastery of the French language. Without going into detail concerning the years immediately following my mission, suffice it to say that I remained very active, whether in branches in Germany and Japan, in a ward near Stanford University, or in several wards in the Salt Lake area, where my understanding and appreciation of Mormonism was enhanced by a number of church assignments, usually involving teaching a priesthood or gospel doctrine class. My church experience and my first marriage both reached a crisis point during the decade from 1966 to 1976, when I lived in the Federal Heights ward in Salt Lake City. During that time, my testimony was alternately bolstered and battered. To To paraphrase Dickens, that period of my life was for me both the best of times and the worst of times. It was the best of times because, among other things, I acquired a number of invaluable friends and was assigned to teach my favorite gospel doctrine class, one on comparative religions for which there was no manual, and to which I was allowed to invite guest speakers representing religions ranging from Judaism to Mohammedanism to Protestantism and Catholicism. It was the worst of times because my first marriage was unraveling, and I was moving into what proved to be a profound clinical depression. It is more than a mere coincidence that during most of the decade, President Harold B. Lee lived in that ward and exerted what I experienced as a distinctly negative influence on me personally. Having said this, I hasten to point out that it is not my intention in this paper deliberately to speak ill of a deceased president who clearly possessed great spiritual powers and organizational skills, and who, though his presidency was the briefest on record, influenced the course of the church more than any leader since the 19th century. However, because my experience of President Lee adversely affected a testimony which I'm now attempting to reassess and hopefully even reinvigorate, I feel compelled to discuss as candidly as possible my impressions of him. My most vivid memory of Harold B. Lee is that of his cold, forbidding presence on the stand of the Federal Heights ward. He sat there impassively, unsmilingly, with an unmistakable look of disdain on his face. I especially recall one of the rare occasions when he spoke to the congregation. He was the main speaker in sacrament meeting, and he used the occasion to lash out at ward members for perceived slights, reminding everyone that he had never felt welcome in the ward and that the members had failed in their duty to open their hearts to the anointed of the Lord. Those in attendance were aghast at this unanticipated and largely unwarranted attack, wondering what more they could have done to reach out to a man whose cultivated remoteness and formal manner discouraged any attempt at intimacy and kept everyone at a safe distance. After the meeting, almost en masse, the congregation pressed in upon the president in an effort to reassure him of their affection and devotion, only to be rebuffed with a few cold, cursory handshakes and an icy glare. In my own mind, I could not help comparing President Lee's distancing, judgmental, carefully controlled manner with the friendly openness of Elder Johnny Woodsell. It was like the difference between a cold, stormy winter night and a warm, inviting summer day. It was common knowledge that President Lee took a lively interest in ward affairs and on occasion intervened directly in their administration. A noteworthy instance of this occurred when Jack Adamson, an outstanding English professor and university administrator who lived in the ward, was assigned to teach a supplementary gospel doctrine class on the Bible as literature, an adaptation of a course for which he was famous at the University of Utah. The class was so well received that inactive ward members began attending in droves, and it became necessary to hold the class in the main meeting hall. The most telling indication of success was the fact that it drew attendance away from the regular gospel doctrine class, which, as it happened, was taught by President Lee's son-in-law. President Lee, at once protective of a close relative and clearly resentful of the success of a non-tithe-paying academic, informed the bishopric in no uncertain terms that they were to terminate Professor Adamson's teaching assignment immediately. Let me just add that I learned the details of this incident at the time directly from a member of the bishopric who was a close personal friend, and I don't want to go into that in any greater detail. It was at about this time that the Colville Tabernacle, which had been identified by the Utah Heritage Society as one of four or five outstanding LDS buildings and was listed on the Utah State Register of Historic Sites, was slated for demolition by the Church Building Committee. Despite extensive protest activities, including a petition signed by 55% of the Colville membership pleading for the tabernacle to be spared, heavy equipment was moved in unannounced in the middle of the night, and the building was razed to the ground. When confronted by a perceived threat to his authority as the living prophet, it was characteristic of Harold B. Lee to respond with the exercise of raw power, which he did in this case by seeing to it that an order to destroy a beloved and irreplaceable historical monument was summarily obeyed. My one positive memory of President Lee had to do with his reaction to a choral presentation of the Book of Job, which I was assigned to write and produce in the Federal Heights Ward as the culmination of a special evening of music and the spoken word. After the performance, President Lee demonstrated that he was open to insights from a liberal source, in this case me, when he commented that for the first time he had achieved a real understanding of the Book of Job. My satisfaction at hearing this was mitigated by the fact that rather than telling me directly, he communicated his impressions to a member of the cast who had read the prologue, the voice out of the whirlwind, and the epilogue. Nevertheless, President Lee's response on this occasion is all the more significant because he was fond of describing a liberal as a Mormon who has lost his testimony. Indeed, one of the most disparaging words in President Lee's vocabulary, and for that matter in the vocabulary of his successors in the church today, was and still is liberal. This negative connotation contrasted strongly with my own understanding of the term, which I associated with generosity, openness, and with progressive, freedom-loving, and truth-seeking pursuits. Furthermore, President Lee's pejorative use of the word directly contradicted Elder Widsoe, who wrote, "The word liberal, correctly used, has a noble meaning. The true liberal hates slavery of every kind. He battles for human freedom. He wants liberty in thought and action. He is tolerant, free from bigotry, and generous in all his deeds. He places truth above all else and hungers for full truth. He welcomes all new improvements and calls for more." Close quote. I find it ironic that however liberal President Lee might have regarded me as being, my testimony was much stronger before I was exposed to him than after. Harold B. Lee took his responsibilities as general authority very seriously, so seriously indeed that there was no room for humor. Indeed, he was probably the most humorless person I have ever encountered. On one occasion, when he was presiding over a session of General Conference, he categorically condemned a moderately humorous remark by a member of the First Quorum of the 70 with the dour observation that levity has no place in the house of the Lord. This clashed harshly with my own deep-seated conviction that there simply has to be a place for humor in the church. After all, there is abundant evidence that Joseph Smith, Brigham Young, and many other church leaders, notably J. Golden Kimball, could be uproariously funny on occasion. I can recall countless conference addresses and sacrament meetings talks which capitalized effectively on comic events and circumstances. Indeed, as J. Golden is reputed to have affirmed, the Lord himself must have a sense of humor, or he would never have allowed certain individuals to occupy positions of leadership in the church. My own experience of President Lee as a no-nonsense, uncompromising, rigorous, and domineering presence made it abundantly clear to me at the time that he was a leader who was sure to leave his mark. However, it was not until much later that I realized that his presidency and the decade leading up to it represented a major turning point not only in my own attitude toward the church, but in the historical development of Mormonism, primarily because of his radical restructuring of the church in the name of correlation. As Robert Gottlieb and Peter Wiley summed it up in their 1984 study of the rise of Mormon power, and they say this, "Under Lee, the church would experience a major overhaul, a little understood and obscure revolution called correlation. It would never be the same again." Close quote. In explaining the full impact of correlation, Gottlieb and Wiley offer the following very insightful explanation. So let me quote this. "Lee had a plan. In 1960, he got Church President McKay to establish a new committee called the Correlation Committee to evaluate the curriculum of all church programs. Lee became the head of the committee and immediately made it the instrument of his far-reaching goals. Lee's masterstroke was turning a limited goal, such as revising and correlating, that is, unifying church curriculum, into a major and prolonged effort to reorganize the church. By the mid-1960s, Lee's Correlation Committee had developed into a major center of power in the church. Lee reached down into the church bureaucracy to select as key aides some younger, ambitious individuals, including Neil A. Maxwell and Boyd K. Packer, who became Lee's troubleshooters in what was now becoming the reorganization of the entire church. Lee could also count on key general authorities such as Marion G. Romney and the newest member of the quorum," this is way back in 61, "Gordon B. Hinckley." Close quote. It is significant that now, 20 years after the passing of President Lee, at least three of these hand-picked lieutenants, Gordon B. Hinckley, Neil A. Maxwell, and Boyd K. Packer, occupy positions of supreme influence in the contemporary hierarchy. I must acknowledge the effectiveness of these Lee men in managing the fortunes of a church which had grown by leaps and bounds while perpetuating the values which President Lee so vigorously espoused, especially in defending the family and the perceived purity of church doctrine against the radical changes of the 60s and the 70s. What I'm saying is that there were definite reasons for the almost paranoid response of President Lee to the circumstances of that time, but there is a continuation of that mentality that seems to me to be inappropriate. All this is a remarkable tribute to President Lee's dedication and strong leadership. It is undeniable that the 13 years of Harold B. Lee's ascendancy culminating in his presidency in 1972, mark a major watershed in the church's development, and that the post-Lee church is vastly different from the pre-Lee church. If President Lee's influence had been a passing phenomenon, I could look back on it as a dark cloud on the horizon, a relatively difficult period which would pass with time. As it turns out, however, he had such a lock on the church that his unrelenting, domineering, mirthless personality can still be felt in the church's leadership style and agenda to this very day. As a reminder of how far the post-Lee church has departed from the course that was originally set for the church, I would like to quote a few telling words of the founding prophet Joseph Smith, and I quote, "No power or influence can or ought to be maintained by virtue of the priesthood, only by persuasion, by long-suffering, by gentleness and meekness, and by love unfeigned, by kindness and pure knowledge, which shall greatly enlarge the soul, without hypocrisy and without guile." Close quote. Those are the words of the prophet Joseph Smith. From having been more flexible and more personal, with leaders expressing a wider range of theological views, the church has become much more autocratic, rigid, narrowly defined, and controlling. I have always been aware of a certain distance between myself as a thinking Mormon, a Mormon concerned with reflecting on the basis and implications of my faith on the one hand, and the straight-arrow Mormon, the true believer, on the other. Increasingly, in the post-Lee church, that distance has become a chasm. To the stalwart true believer, who is a total stranger to doubt, has never wavered in his or her adherence to the basic Mormon belief system, the Mormon intellectual, who finds it either difficult or impossible to accept the church's literalistic supernatural claims, is viewed as a hopeless heretic, a shameless backslider, a selective sympathizer who constitutes a menace to all one whole sacred. On the other hand, the selective sympathizer, while seeking to maintain some kind of viable relationship with the church, but unable to reconcile perceived contradictions and inconsistencies in one or more of the core beliefs, cannot help regarding the true believer as hopelessly self-deluded and insufferably self-righteous. And I do think there's a real dichotomy there. This chasm is all the more difficult to bridge because of an ironic disparity at the core of the organization. On the one hand, the institutional church claims uncompromisingly that it enjoys direct divine guidance through an ordained living prophet. On the other hand, the sad but undeniable decline in the mental and physical ability of the church's frail and disabled president makes it virtually impossible for him to serve as a true leader with any real credibility as a conduit for divine revelation. If my experience of Harold B. Lee and his pervasive influence tended more and more to alienate me from the church as an institution, the bitterness and disillusionment of my divorce nearly 16 years ago seriously undermined my faith in one of the fundamentals of Mormon religion, the temple marriage for time and eternity. Whatever reservations I might have had about the other precepts of Mormonism, I was firmly convinced that a marriage solemnized in the temple was destined to last. As I related at the Pillar of My Faith session in 1984, I'd just like to quote briefly, I overreacted by writing off Mormonism as a bad investment and deciding it would be best for the church and me to go our separate ways. It did not take very long, however, for me to realize two things. First, I could not lightly dismiss a religion which had become so much a part of me. And second, I had unwittingly lapsed back into the simplistic all-or-nothing kind of thinking that Elder Widtsoe had helped me to rise above. I was tacitly agreeing with the advocates of monolithic Mormonism, who insist that one must accept the church in its entirety or reject it out of hand. Close quote. In a word, I succumbed briefly to the temptation to throw the baby out with the bathwater, the very thing which at all costs I want to avoid at this important juncture in my life. An essential ingredient in any testimony is the role of truth, all the more so because, by definition, the gospel of Jesus Christ is based on truths of the highest order. The Savior himself declared, "Ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." Declaring that one knows the gospel is true and expressing one's conviction of the truth of Joseph Smith's first vision are stock phrases that every faithful saint expects to hear when a testimony is being born. It is therefore supremely ironic and deeply tragic that the post-Lee church continues to do violence to the truth by either denying it, subverting it, or conveniently redefining it. At this point, I will refrain from reciting a litany of examples of official truth manipulation, since that topic is central to so many other symposium presentations. One key example will suffice. In his 1985 BYU address, "Truth and More," and more are underlined, not truth, and more is underlined, Elder Russell Nelson declared that the merciful companion to truth is, underlined, silence, especially if it is the kind of truth for which, in his view, and I quote, "self-serving historians grovel," close quote, whenever they bring to light facts that might embarrass the hierarchy or detract from the sanitized official view of the church's past. One can only speculate what would have been the reaction of B.H. Roberts, John A. Widso, or for that matter the Prophet Joseph Smith himself, to this kind of self-serving Jesuitical casuistry. Returning again to the metaphor that I utilized in the title of my remarks, I am faced with the need to dispose of a good deal of bathwater before I can hope to discover the, quote, baby, the essential residue of my testimony. For me, a testimony of the gospel, that is, a testimony based on the fundamental theological principles of Mormonism, has always taken precedence over a testimony of the church, that is, a lockstep alignment with the institution. Since, in a manner of speaking, the post-Lee Church has effectively thrown out the baby and kept only the bathwater, I consider the most important single step in the sorting out process to be the rejection of the church's current self-serving insistence that a valid testimony is founded on obedience to the leadership of the institutional church. Finding the church with its present orientation profoundly inimical and virtually impossible to relate to, I feel suspended, as it were, between two worlds. On the one hand, there is the warmly remembered past, the halcyon days when I had ready access to church stalwarts and kindred spirits like John A. Widso and James L. Barker. On the other hand, there is an uncertain future, and the fond hope, that I suspect it's nothing more than a hope, it's one I still foster, that the pendulum of Mormonism must eventually swing back to a kinder, less self-righteous, more open and humane posture, one in which Christian love replaces the Old Testament vindictiveness which permeates the church at present. As I think back to the time when I attended and participated in fast and testimony meetings, I remember how close the wording and intonation of each testimony were to those of all the others, and how much saying the right words served to reassure those present, including oneself, that we all believed in the right God, that we belonged to the right church, in a word, that we were indeed all in the right pew, and that we had anecdotal evidence to prove it. The net effect was to create the impression that there was a certain distance between the testimony and the person bearing it, that the whole process was an ostentatious act of displaying one's credentials as a bona fide saint in good standing and holding up an impressive checklist for all to see. Having distanced myself from the setting where it is customary to bear a testimony and discovering no convenient ready-made phrases to put on display, I am forced to conclude that my struggle to locate the metaphoric baby somewhere out there is misguided. If indeed there is a baby to be found, I must reach deep inside myself to find it. As it turns out, the baby is really none other than myself, or rather the person I have become as a result of having unconsciously incorporated into the very fabric of my being the basic Mormon tenets that played such a vital role during my formative years. I cannot hope to tease out all the strands of my internalized testimony on this occasion, but I can identify the key ones quite easily. Let me begin by describing myself first and foremost as a humanist. After all, I've been a professor of languages, literature, and the history of ideas for more than 30 years, and it is the role of a professor to profess something. So I have consistently professed a set of humanistic values, which for me have their basis in Mormon theology, and which have subtly and unmistakably colored the way in which I have taught and written in my field. I wouldn't go so far as to say that I always was bearing a testimony when I was presenting a paper or giving a lecture, but there was an element of that in there, unmistakably. So what might those values be? Though I cannot say with the requisite degree of certainty that Joseph Smith was a divinely ordained prophet, I know that he was on to something when he defined men and women as the literal children of God, endowed with free moral agency and capable of eternal progression. Thanks primarily to my Mormon background, I am profoundly convinced that we are both free and morally responsible, that at the core of our being we can all discover a divine spark, and that through discipline and study we are capable of boundless improvement and development, not just in this life, but also in a life to come. I am deeply convinced that Joseph Smith was right on when he taught that the glory of God is intelligence and that man is that he might have joy. Using the gastronomical imagery attributed to Joseph Smith, I would say that these core doctrines must be true because they taste good. And if that's not enough, I find that they make eminent good sense and have great practical value in everyday living. I would like to add that I am deeply grateful for the life-affirming, optimistic orientation which Mormonism early on gave my humanistic leanings. In conclusion, I suspect that as testimonies go, the one I have attempted to articulate here this morning is probably, as unorthodox as just about any you could hope to find. Whatever the case, it is my testimony, not one that has been prescribed, pre-approved, or pre-digested in any way, and I value it highly because it has stood the test of time. And it proves at least one significant thing, that no matter how alienated a person may feel from the organizational church and its minions, the fundamental doctrines of the Mormon religion will continue to resonate in the heart of anyone who has been truly touched by them. And that, I would submit, is tantamount to a genuine testimony. Let me add a final word of advice to anyone who, for whatever reason, has moved from ardent belief and total immersion in Mormon religion to extreme disaffection, as I have. Denying what the church has meant to you, and on some level still means to you, would be as hypocritical as pretending to be a compliant true believer. In other words, whatever you do, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dick. I think we have all enjoyed listening to his spiritual journey. It's comforting to know that people I admire suffer similar doubts and rejoice in similar awakenings. Much of this paper deals with Dick's experience of Harold B. Lee. I had only one encounter with President Lee when he toured the New England Mission. At the time, I thought he was older, therefore wiser, and probably preoccupied with matters beyond my ken. Now I would say he was aloof and condescending, and I would probably be far less inclined to attribute his demeanor to higher spiritual sensitivity. I have changed, and with those changes, so has my interpretation of President Lee's behavior. I suspect the same might have been true for Dick. That is, if he had been 20 when he observed President Lee's behavior, it might have not had the same effect as it did when he was, 35, 40. Obviously, Dick's acquaintance with President Lee accelerated his loss of faith in the church. But I suggest that ultimately there may have been more fundamental causes. First, Dick had sufficient spiritual maturity to make a critical assessment of an apostle's behavior and be deeply affected by it. Most Latter-day Saints have such a need for authority in whom they can have implicit trust and confidence that they either cannot see or simply gloss over unchristian behavior by general authorities. Second, in spite of being a Uton, Dick is a 20th century man and Latter-day Saints are 19th. Well-educated Mormons who balance the life of the mind with the life of the spirit have three options. Compartmentalize, struggle futilely to reconcile orthodoxy and integrity, or sacrifice one or the other. Dick chose integrity. President Lee may have been a catalyst, but it was Dick's choice. My guess is that most active members of the Federal Heights Ward, observing the same behavior, compartmentalized or chose orthodoxy. Now, to Dick, John A. Widsoe was a father figure, and he remains an exemplary leader. But to E.E. Erickson, my grandfather, John A. Widsoe was, I don't think even he would have used the word, but I believe he thought it, a hypocrite. Erickson worked with Widsoe for many years on the MIA General Board. To him, Widsoe posed as an open-minded scholar, but when push came to shove, it was Widsoe, supporting J. Reuben Clark, that squelched freedom of thought and expression on the board and presided over its demise in 1938. Whose assessment of Widsoe was right, Erickson or Cummings? My point is that while we must be true to our experience and report it honestly, we should temper with charity those we criticize and with caution those we admire. Our experience is just that, our experience. Dick believes that President Lee influenced the course of the church more than any leader since the 19th century. I'm not sure how one would verify such a statement, but I would point out that correlation committees operated in church auxiliaries from the early 20th century, and while no doubt the correlation committee has had an unprecedented chilling effect on Mormonism, it was not correlation that established the Committee on Strengthening Church Members, nor was it correlation or Harold B. Lee that created J. Reuben Clark, Joseph Fielding Smith, Mark Peterson, Ezra Taft Benson, Bruce McConkie, Dallin Oaks, or Russell Nelson. I am no fan of Harold B. Lee either, but I don't give him so much credit for ruining Mormonism. While I agree that particularly in recent decades, emphasis has been increasingly played on obedience and conformity, I have to take exception with the idea that there ever was a time when Jesus was the key to a Mormon testimony. It may have been so for Dick and many others individually. But as a people, I think we have always taken the divinity of Jesus Christ as a given. The critical issue of a Mormon testimony has always been that Joseph Smith is a prophet and the corollary, his successors have been and always will be prophets. That is what distinguishes Mormons from the rest of Christianity, and that is what has driven the church as an institution. It was Joseph who declared himself to be the sole spokesman for God to the church. Many others put in their 2 cents worth along the way, but Mormonism has been authoritarian since 1830. You can't talk about the baby in the bathwater without considering truth. I've always loved the statement Dick quoted, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." That you know it's equally true that you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you mad. Nobody likes to be wrong, and new truths show us how wrong we have been. Dick is mad because church leaders dissemble and suppress historical truth, but I suggest what he's really mad about is the fact that he was wrong. It was wrong to have overlooked the basic truth that it is the nature and disposition of almost all men, as soon as they become general authorities, to exercise unrighteous dominion. The basic truth that it is the nature and disposition of almost all men, as soon as they become general authorities, to exercise unrighteous dominion. I would remind you that Joseph rewrote history and revelations to support his current understanding of truth. His history of Missouri suppressed his knowledge of and involvement with the Danites. And it was no doubt his deceptions about pre-manifesto polygamy that justified Joseph F. Smith and other leaders who lied about post-manifesto polygamy. Lying for the Lord is a time-honored Mormon tradition. Mormon ends always justify the means. But despite its faults, 19th century Mormonism addressed the spirit of the times, gave women and men a sense of purpose and meaning, called forth the best from their hearts, minds, and souls. A lot of water has passed under the bridge since those days. Mormon is no longer intellectually vigorous or spiritually healthy. We are a dysfunctional family. The question is, where do we go from here? My sense that it is that it's time to pull a plug. Let the bathwater drain. It's time we focused on the poor, malnourished baby, if there is still any life in it. And if there isn't, we should be about creating a faith that is as relevant and inspiring for the 21st century as Mormonism was for the 19th. Richard, I hope you will never undervalue the contribution that you have to make to this community. So-called apostles who seek to deify the church blaspheme the God they claim to speak for. What is needed is not apostles of the church, but apostles of truth, apostles of goodness, apostles of beauty. I look to you, Dick Cummings, as one of those apostles. And it is my sincere hope that in the coming year, as you tease out the strands of your internalized testimony, that you will elaborate on them and articulate them, and above all, come and share them with us in next year's Sunstone Symposium. We have succeeded in preserving 5 minutes for your questions and comments. Yes?
Neither one of you established how you actually deal with the church on a practical basis. You go to meetings, you participate in their often very boring presentations. How do you deal with it?
You want to answer that?
Okay, I'll answer while I'm here. I've given up on the church. I think it's pointless to resist it, to try to reform it, or to try to make a silt spurs out of a cow's ear. I think that there's a lot of good in Mormonism, but it's not going to flourish in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
I'm afraid I'm not quite that far with it. I haven't completely given up on the church, but I'm not willing to align myself with the church at the present time. I find it very difficult to attend church meetings and maintain any kind of a sense of integrity, because the assumption is if you are in church, you basically buy into what's going on there. You basically buy into certain expectations, which I simply cannot subscribe to. And the closest I can come is to simply say that historically, pendulums do swing, and I can't see how it can swing any further in the direction it has it presently occupies. It's got to come back at some point. And hopefully, by then, there'll be something that one can indeed subscribe to. There'll be something one can feel comfortable with. And there'll be more latitude, where you don't come in there and it's expected that you're going to be in lockstep alignment with everything that goes on. I think this hand went up over here. Yes? Yes? Well, let me comment on that from my vantage point, and then Scott can answer it from his. In my case, yes, the first marriage didn't fare very well, and my children basically were pretty much disillusioned with the church fairly early on, maybe just living in the Federal Heights ward, which is a very upscale place to be, and I had children who were not well served by that particular setting. And I wasn't insisting, of course, that they stay in the fold in any way whatsoever. I actually have been happily remarried for, what, the past 12 years, 13 years? 12 years. 12 years it is, yes. And my wife is right here. As a matter of fact, I don't know how to say this except that I believe Julie was more involved in the church when she met me than she is now. And I don't know what my influence has been. She'd have to be the one to respond to that. We seem to be on the same wavelength, which helps the marriage a great deal, but it means that there's not very much involvement in the church. We regularly have our favorite home teacher come and visit us. They tried to send another home teacher to us one day, and we said, don't bother, we'll call you, don't you call us. And they sent the right one to us. And so we maintain that much of a tie to the church. I don't know if that answers your question or not, but I think Scott may have more to say. Oh, yes, that's true. I have a son who died actually a little bit more than a year and a half ago of AIDS, which was something that was very, very difficult for me to accept. But I had established a very good relationship with him. I was able to accept what turned out to be his orientation. I was able to be with him and support him right up until the very, very bitter end. And so I would say that out of the divorce and the fact that things kind of got realigned in some way, I had a much better relationship with both my children. My daughter and I are also very close now, and that has all worked out very well. Scott?
Well, I can just say I'm very fortunate to have married the woman that I married. When I first proposed to Susan, I was a true believer. By the time we got married 12 years later, I was a liberal. And now, 14 or 15 years after that, I'm, I suppose, a hopeless heretic. And through all of that, the church has remained very important to Susan. She served for several years on the primary general board. She'd worked with the primary general music committee. She just got through helping the church record all the primary songs on diskette for distribution in the church. She leads the ward choir. She goes to church every week. She takes the children with her. At the same time, she's very supportive of me personally. And I'm sure that's not easy for her. She's also a professor at BYU. Fortunately, in the music department. The other half of it, my family, the children, is much more difficult. I have not been terribly outspoken in front of the children about the church, but they get it. And I have been candid with them, but not... I've not tried to convert them. And so they're 15 and 13 years old and go to church every Sunday and are as true believers as I was at age 20. That's life.
Your points are all well taken, Steve. And I was in a somewhat different frame of mind at the time that I gave that address back then than I am now. Because of my own personal temperament and the way I've been affected by some of the developments in the church since that time, I just cannot, in good conscience, attend meetings in any way that is going to be supportive of what people are trying to do there. Inevitably, I just get irritated, and I just feel the need to get up and leave.
Dick, remember that hypocrisy is the oil that lubricates the
fire. All right, Levi, I appreciate that. I'm glad to know that there is an oil that you can fall back on. But I just wanted to acknowledge what you're saying, Steve. And I think anyone who is so disposed ought not to give up completely on the possibility of exercising change in the right direction, however slight, however much time it might take. If that is your temperamental disposition, then I would simply say, absolutely go for it. But I cannot myself function that way. And a lot of things have happened since that time. And I hope, I wanted, if nothing else, I wanted at this particular point, I wanted my remarks to have on balance a positive effect. I wanted to remind you that even somebody who doesn't attend church, who can't accept the organization per se, is still very much a product of the basic beliefs that I once accepted along with everything else. And I think that this is true. I've run into so many people who have been so embittered that they can't even acknowledge what good has actually come of their involvement in the church. And I really was trying to invoke that kind of response on the part of people who may be much more desperate than you are in their attitude toward these things. I don't know how much more time we have. We've got another group coming in. Maybe, let's see, one more question.
Well, I just wanted to say it is really unfortunate
by them to blame it on the church. Well, I think we all have to make our own determination about that sort of thing. Okay, one last question.